could I please have your attention? I guess we're there's some disagreement up here about what time we're supposed to start. It's 4:30, so we're actually about five minutes behind.
Yeah,
and I'm one of these people. I came up in a very strict home where punctuality was next to godliness, that you started and got going right on time. So I apologize in advance for this for being a bit late. But this session is what is the session number? It's
I don't know.
But anyway, it's a preview of coming volumes in the series Persistence of Polygamy. And my name is Newell Bringhurst. And we've got a panel of people that are going to talk not only about Volume 1, which is already in print. This is the first of a projected three-volume trilogy, which deals with various aspects of Mormon polygamy. From its beginnings, its origins under Joseph Smith, all the way down to the present-day fundamentalist Mormonism. The first volume focuses exclusively on Joseph Smith and the origins of polygamy, and that will be discussed in terms of a couple of the presentations. We'll evaluate and critique those essays in the first volume, but also this session will deal with kind of giving a preview about what's going to appear in volumes 2 and 3. Volume 2 is going to be dealing with post-Joseph Smith polygamy from 1844 through the Woodruff Manifesto of 1890. And then volume 3 will deal with fundamentalist Mormonism from 1890 down to the present. And the order of presentation in discussing these topics will, our first presenter will be Craig Foster, and I know him so well he hardly needs an introduction. But for those who don't know Craig, he is an established scholar who is a research specialist with the LDS Church Family History Library. And he's the author or co-author, co-editor of three previously published works, including The Persistence of Polygamy, which he co-edited with me, as well as a book that we're in the process of finishing up on the Mormon quest for the presidency. We had a session dealing with aspects of that book this morning. And Craig will give you an overview of what's going to be contained in volumes 2 and 3, and then that'll be followed by Anne Wild. Now, Anne Wild is she's worked very closely with me, and I've gotten to know her very well over the last several years as we've moved forward on these volumes. She's been a wonderful resource person, try to give you a little bit of a background on Anne. Was born and raised in the LDS Church and is a BYU graduate. She has been an independent fundamentalist Mormon for over 40 years. Anne is probably best known as the co-author of Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. And she has been a co-founder and community relations director of Principal Voices. Have they changed the name of that organization I saw?
No, Principal Voices and Principal Rights Coalition are two different
organizations.
Okay, but I'm on both.
On both. And she will be our second presenter. Our third presenter will be Mary Ann T. Watson, who is a freelance genealogist and family historian. She resides in Lehigh, Utah, and is the mother of 9 and the grandmother of 13. She was born and raised in plural marriage within a fundamentalist Mormon community. And so she is a co-author along with Anne. She's a member of the Apostolic United Brethren. And I've gotten to know her and her husband over the last several years, Dave, and we've become very good friends with them. And she is contributing two essays, which will appear in Volume 3. I should mention that Anne has an essay that's also going to be appearing in Volume 3. And then our last speaker is Brian Hales, who has also written extensively in the area of fundamentalist Mormonism. But his day job, he's not, you'd think he's a professional author, he's a very prolific writer, but his day job is an anesthesiologist at Davis Hospital and Medical Center in Layton, Utah. Author of Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto, which received the Best Book Award from the John Whitmer Historical Society. So they will go in that order, and as I say, hopefully we'll have time afterwards for plenty of questions. I should acknowledge that one of the other contributors to Volume 1, Don Bradley, if there were room, I'd probably have him up here too, but he wrote one of the outstanding essays that appeared in Volume 1. He also co-authored an essay that's going to appear in Volume 2. And so we'll just go ahead in that order.
Okay. Shall I just sit
Well, do you want to just sit there and or
why
you
don't
can
just stand so okay. They can see.
Yeah,
you
okay.
Can,
yeah. All right.
And I'll just do musical chairs, I guess.
I guess so. Okay. As Newell said, we are going to. The second volume for The Persistence of Polygamy will be post-Joseph Smith. It'll be from 1844 to 1890. And among the essays that we are going to have in the volume, and I'll just kind of read some of them off to give you an idea, we are going to have two essays dealing with Brigham Young, specifically with the Brigham Young household. The first one is by Jeffrey O. Johnson, For Time and All Eternity, The Complex Brigham Young Polygamous Households. And the other essay will be by George D. Smith, Brigham Young Reluctant Polygamist. Then Newell and I will be co-authoring an essay tentatively titled, What Happened to All of Brigham Young's Plural Wives? A Historiographical Inquiry into Changing Mormon Perceptions, for those of you who keep track of interesting stuff like that. You'll notice that Brigham's wives seem to have disappeared over time in official church publications and stuff. So we're going to be kind of looking at that. Then Connell O'Donovan is going to have an essay about plural marriage in African Americans, Race, Schism, and the Beginnings of Black Priesthood Denial in Utah Mormonism. Vicki Speak, who some of you might be aware, published a book, a biography of James J. Strang. She will do an essay, James J. Strang and His Followers, Plural Marriage and Family Relationships. And then Christopher Blythe is going to do an essay about some of the other break-offs, or whatever you want to call it, and it's titled Three Schismatic Mormon Leaders and Plural Marriage, Alphaeus Cutler, William Smith, and Lyman White. Guy Bishop, M. Guy Bishop, is going to do an essay on Sidney Rigdon and Stephen Post, two Mormon schismatic foes of polygamy. One of the goals that we had for Volume 2 particularly was to try to put this within a greater context. We have essays about the LDS. We have essays about the RLDS, but we wanted to look at some of the other groups that came from the original Restoration Movement and what their views were regarding plural marriage. So that's why we have these essays dealing with the other groups like the Strangites and the Cutlerites, etc. Don Bradley and Brian Hales have an essay titled LDS. Actually, I think the title was changed, but from what we have here, but we have here LDS Joseph versus RLDS Joseph: Records of Nauvoo Polygamy and the Conflict That Forged Them. Then we have a gentleman who's a member of the Community of Christ, Lewis Wiegand, who, this was really kind of interesting. We were talking about the volume, and he said, "Now, are you going to say anything about the RLDS who were polygamists?" And Newell and I both went, "What?" And he said, "Well, as you know, we had a number of people who returned from Utah back to the Midwest who became RLDS." And we said, yes, we know that. He said, "Well, several of them were polygamists, and they continued to practice plural marriage." So he's going to have a short essay dealing with that. We thought that was just absolutely fascinating. Then Andrea Ratke Moss is going to have an essay titled "Mormon Polygamist Promotion of Women's Rights During the Late 19th Century." And Laurie Winter Stromberg will have an essay titled "Prisoners for the Principle: The Incarceration of Mormon Plural Wives, 1882 to 1890. Richard P. Howard, who is the former RLDS church historian, will have an essay titled "The RLDS Church's Changing Policy on Plural Marriage in RLDS Doctrine and Covenants, Section 150. So that will be volume two, and as you can see, it's a number of essays, but we think it's going to be a good, strong book that will be of interest to a number of people because of the different perspectives. Volume three will be from 1890 to the present, and we are really excited about this volume, and are still in the middle of doing research for essays in the volume. We have several people, some of whom are on the panel. Ann Wild is going to do an essay on Doctrine and Covenants, Section 132.
She has done it. Yeah,
she has done it, yes.
I've already turned mine in.
Yes.
Yeah, she's one of the people that we congratulate.
She's one of the good ones. Though, yeah. we had three essays in the first volume dealing with aspects of Doctrine and Covenants 132, and now Anne has done an essay that looks at it from a fundamentalist perspective. Mary Ann Watson is going to have two essays. She has an essay that talks about early fundamentalist Mormons, and then I'll wait and get to the next one in a moment. But Christopher Blythe, is also going to have an essay in here talking about proto-fundamentalism. Then, as I said, Mary Ann has her essay on early fundamentalism. Ken Driggs, who has written quite a bit about fundamentalism, particularly the FLDS, Ken is going to have one essay about Truth Magazine, so Joseph White Musser's Truth Magazine and the significant role that it played. And then he is going to have an essay about the FLDS Centennial Park split. So that should be rather interesting. There's going to be an essay that will give an overview of the Apostolic United Brethren. That will be done by Joseph Lyman Jessup. And Joe Jessup is going to do a second essay, kind of a reminiscence of growing up within an AUB community. He grew up in Pinesdale, Montana. And so I've read the essay. He's still, he gave us a first draft, and it's an excellent essay. It's from a very personal approach there. Eric Paul Rogers is going to have an essay about Reuel and Allred and the Apostolic United Brethren. Marianne Watson is going to have an essay, and for the life of me, I could not remember the title. So this is a very long title, kind of slash explanation, but it's going to be a look at the Nauvoo Polygamy Foundations of Modern Fundamentalists, for lack of a better way of saying it. Basically, she did a survey among a number of fundamentalists from the different groups, asking them about various questions about plural marriage, and also asking as whether or not they, when their first ancestors, if they came from, you know, early Mormon families, when they joined the church, if they practiced plural marriage. She gave a presentation on that down in St. George in May at the Mormon History Association Conference, and it was excellent. Since I love genealogy, I was practically falling out of my seat just enjoying all the information. Then Newell Bringhurst has an essay on the reaction among the various fundamentalists to the YFZ ranch raid that took place in 2008. And then Newell and I have been doing research and are continuing to do research for an essay where we will look at the personalities and the administrations of Rulon Jeffs and Warren Jeffs. So given recent events, that ought to prove to be interesting. And Newell is also, he has an essay dealing with the views of blacks in priesthood among fundamentalist groups. And rounding this out, and I want to emphasize that this is still, you know, we're still moving things around, and so the volume 3 is kind of in flux. But rounding things out, since we only have a few essays here, is an essay that I have tentatively titled "Like Two Crazy Ants in the Attic." And the reason why I titled it that way is that the subtitle is Modern Polygamy Stereotypes and Modern Mormon Discomfort Over Their Polygamous Past. And so that's why I referred to it like Two Crazy Ants in the Attic, given how some members of the LDS Church look at their own history, even. So it ought to be... interesting.
You got one other essay, Todd Compton's historiographical essay.
Oh, my heavens, how could I forget that?
Ahead.
That's
major. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
Todd Compton and Pat Scott worked together on a historiographical essay wherein, you know, they brought in all of the literature not all the literature, but a good amount of the literature dealing with plural marriage. And so they have an essay discussing the literature, basically the historiography of plural marriage, publications on plural marriage. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we're looking toward for the next two volumes.
We're playing musical chairs.
Yeah. Yes, we are.
I'll move down a notch, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Well, this has been a big week in the polygamy world, if you to put it mildly, but I'm not going to address that. But because of that, because of some of the sessions that we've had on polygamy in the Sunstone this year, and because of reading the volume 1 of this, I first want to start with clarifications on 4 points. And they seem to be repeated many times or misunderstood, and so I would like to kind of set the record straight right at the beginning so we're all on the same page. I'm looking at the audience and I'm preaching to the choir here a little bit, but I'm glad to have some support in the audience too. To begin with, one of the pet peeves that we have
as fundamentalist Mormons is to all be classified and grouped together in the same fashion. That contemporary polygamists all do this, or we all do that. And, you know, there's just as much diversity among fundamentalist Mormons as there are, as Marianne puts it, among, or visit Linda, anyway, among American Indian tribes. I mean, they all have their idiosyncrasies and beliefs and practices, and we are just the same. And when you hear about the FLDS, they have practices and beliefs that the rest of us don't adhere to. We don't condone. And so I don't know if you read in the paper that the Principal Rights Coalition did issue a statement separating ourselves from, excuse me, from some of those practices. We do not condone underage marriages, forced marriages, welfare fraud, any of those stereotypes that you might have heard of. We, as a coalition, have gone to the leaders of the various groups, and they have all publicly stated that they will no longer encourage or perform underage marriages, which in the state of Utah is the age of 18. We're hoping that they comply and continue with that promise. So that's one of the things that I have seen through the past week and even before. We have to keep reiterating that distinction that there are many different groups. There are independents, and I've said this in some of my presentations before, but just so that we're all on the same page, you cannot lump all fundamentalist Mormons together. Another thing is, I've heard the statement several times, that you have to live plural marriage in order to be saved, to have salvation. I'm sure most of you in the audience should know the difference between salvation and exaltation. I compiled a little book a while ago, An Essential for Exaltation, and it's not me that put forth this idea. It's 33 references where the scriptures or early leaders have said that in order to get to the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, which is exaltation, you have to live celestial plural marriage. Now notice the words in there, celestial plural marriage. It doesn't mean polygamy. It doesn't just mean plural marriage. It means it's on a high level, a spiritual level, where your wives hopefully get along well together. The man is fair. It's a spiritual relationship. It's based on having families. So that is where the statement comes from. But you do not have to live plural marriage in order to enter the kingdom of God, in order to be saved for salvation. The Savior provided that universally for all of us with his atonement. We all are entitled to salvation. So I just wanted to make the distinction between salvation and exaltation. The next one is, Jacob 2 is often quoted as a reason why we should not live plural marriage. Who was Jacob talking to in Jacob 2? He was talking to wicked. He was talking to wealthy. He was talking to, I have it listed here, excessive riches, pride, expensive apparel, persecution of their brethren. And Jacob goes on to say, you aren't supposed to live this anymore, because you're abusing it. And so God, in his wisdom, I would say, said, okay, it's not for the people. But do we know that the leaders at that time were not living it? Maybe they were saying one thing publicly and then doing another thing privately. Does this remind you of Joseph Smith, where he'd get up in a meeting and say, oh, we aren't living plural marriage, and he's already had a few plural wives. One time he got up in a meeting and he said, he just kind of threw out just a hint of plural marriage, and between the meetings, the Relief Society sisters came to him and raked him over the coals for even mentioning it. And so he got up at the next meeting and said, oh, apologize for having said that. But he did not apologize that it was, or taking it back, because it was a true statement. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. But it's important, I think, to realize the conditions that existed at the time Jacob gave that statement in the scriptures. In a way, it reminds me of the manifesto. Half the church, at least, didn't want to live plural marriage, or they weren't living it. There was never over, I think Lynn Bennion comes up with 30% maybe of the men or the church that was actually living plural marriage. So if the majority of a group of people don't want to adhere to something, do you think the Lord's going to force them to live that? I had a thought come to me as I was driving up here this morning. It's kind of an analogy. Say that a couple has two sons, and one of them turns 18. He's been a good son. So the couple, the parents, give him a car. And they said, now the conditions are that you take care of that car. You get it lubed, you wash it, you drive safely on the road, you don't get into tickets. And the 16-year-old accepted that on those conditions and did very well. Then along comes the 16-year-old younger brother. When he turns 16, he gets a car with the same conditions. Now the first one, the 18-year-old, and he's now 18, has taken very good care of this car. It was a gift from his parents, and he obeyed all the laws and everything. But the 16-year-old, the younger one, when he turned 16, he didn't keep it very clean, and he did pretty well. And then he didn't keep it clean or lubed, and pretty soon he comes home with a speeding ticket, and then after a while he comes home with a reckless driving ticket. Well, what are the parents going to do? That son didn't keep the conditions of that gift. And so what would a wise parent do in that situation? Would they let him keep on driving and risk the lives or the safety of other people on the road as well as the son? So as a parent, what would you do? If I were the parent, I'd say, I'm sorry, you didn't keep the conditions of the gift I gave you, so I'm taking that away from you. You can no longer benefit from that gift. This might be a crude analogy, but I can kind of see that in polygamy. The Lord gave it by a revelation to Joseph Smith. Then when the people themselves did not really appreciate it and possibly, in many cases, lived it unworthily, then he said, okay, I'm taking that gift back. Now, that's, like I say, a crude analogy, but maybe you can visualize the fact that at first, when that revelation was received by Joseph Smith in 1843, it was a priesthood law. It was not accepted by the church. And so until 1852, it was a law of the priesthood. Then in 1852, the church voted on it, and it became a law of the church and the priesthood, both. Then later on, in Manifesto, and especially 1904, it was no longer a tenet of the church, but it continued on as a priesthood law, similar to the car. See what I mean? They got it. He didn't appreciate the gift, so it was taken away. So that's kind of an analogy I've come up with to explain Jacob 2 and the manifesto. And one more thing is the number 4 point I want to clarify. Frequently you hear David and Solomon being criticized for the many wives they had, and but they were not criticized for living plural marriage. Nathan gave David his wives with the blessing of the Lord. But it was when they took unrighteous wives, they multiplied wives, they defiled the temple. That's the point when their polygamy became unrighteous. So I don't like to hear people say, oh, David and Solomon, it was wrong that they lived plural marriage. You have to reach a point where it was righteous at first and then it became unrighteous. Do you have any questions on that particular part? I wanted to make sure we all understood those points. Okay, quickly going on here. How many of you have read Volume 1, so I don't repeat myself too much, A Persistence of Polygamy? How many of you have read? Just one? Okay, well, I'm not going to repeat too much. Okay, I'm very glad when I read that, because anything that will defend and support the polygamy that Joseph Smith lived, I'm 100% in favor of. And to me, this book was an example of a lot of scholarly historical research that defended Joseph Smith and kind of acquitted him of some of the charges that had been made against him. The polyandry, the marrying underage young girls, things like that that have bothered me since I started learning about polygamy. But I justify that in my own mind. And so I've been able to understand that, but until I read this book and found research and scholarly evidence to a lot of these things, and some of them are still undecided, I really am thrilled that they had the scholarly evidence that they did in reading this book. I recommend it to all of you. Just quickly, it had 8 essays in it, and I'm not going to go at length through each one, but there were some meaningful things that I learned from each of these essays. For example, the first one was on Fanny Alger from Don Bradley. Was that an affair? Was it a marriage? And maybe there's a difference of opinion, but he came to the conclusion with the evidence that he was able to get that that was a marriage, that was not an adulterous affair. I appreciated that. In the section, in number two, the essay was by Newell Bringhurst, The Complex and Controversial Nature of One, Section 132. He says that it was an accumulation of Joseph Smith's revelations on plural marriage, which I totally agree with, and I'll bring that out in my essay. He quotes Brigham Young as saying, "No man could be exalted in heaven without the application of the principles involved, that it is essential for exaltation." Naturally, that goes right along with my beliefs. The next essay, Expanding the Concept of Family by Craig Foster, he also says that 132 is an amalgamation of revelations that Joseph received prior to 1843, and that there is more evidence than not that celestial marriage and plural marriage were used interchangeably. And this is the very first part of my essay, that these terms were used interchangeably. The fourth essay was by Brian Hales and talked about the polyandry. And by the way, if you want to pick up an excellent CD, if you didn't go to his session this morning, I highly recommend it. What a wealth of information and research on Joseph Smith and polygamy, emphasizing the polyandry part. And I love the fact that he comes up with his research that he was probably guilty of ceremonial polyandry rather than sexual polyandry. Now, Michael Quinn's going to differ with that. He believes that he did have intimacy with his polyandrous wives. You know, to me, that doesn't really make a lot of difference. I have a testimony that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God. I also read a quote that he said in May 26th of 1844, which would be just a month before he died. He said, quote, "I am innocent of all charges of adultery." Well, from his own lips, we may not understand some of those things. I'm sure we don't. But I'd rather give him the benefit of the doubt so that when and if I am able and privileged to meet him on the other side, I'm not going to be critical of some of the things that he did that I don't understand. So, like I said, I'd rather give him the benefit of the doubt on that. Essay 5 on Volume 1 was about the ages of Joseph Smith's wives. Foster, Keller, and Smith wrote that one. These authors show that the ages of Joseph Smith's wives were well within the norm for that time and place. He did marry two girls that were 14, nearly 15, but teenage marriages at that time were four times more common than they are now. Thought that was an interesting point. We have to realize the difference between the times of then and now. Essay 6, Analysis of Marriage Ages in the United States by Todd Compton. He's talking about figures that include the Nauvoo and Utah periods of time in the 19th century. It's kind of ironic in a way that some of the people today that live plural marriage use the example of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young taking young wives as a reason for them to do that. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's interesting that now that's one of the complaints against polygamous Mormons today, is that they marry these young girls. But here, you know, it was a common thing, and it's it was practiced by Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. The seventh essay was DNA Analysis of Joseph Smith's by Ugo Perigo.
Perigo.
Yeah. And I noticed just a couple of weeks ago, I think it was July, in the Desert News, they had an article. He talks about the DNA evidence of the children that were suspected or supposed might be blood birth children of Joseph Smith. And so he does the DNA analysis of all of them and comes up with the conclusion that there were no polygamous children from his polygamous wives. Only ones that they could absolutely prove were the ones that Emma had, the nine children. However, he does say, which I thought was interesting, he could have had some, and there's Josephine and there's different stories. I'm not saying this is definitive. I'm just saying this is what was reported in the article. He said there's a possibility that they could have died at birth or young and buried, and we wouldn't have known that as the information came down. So, but the evidence he found was that there were no birth children from Joseph Smith and his plural wives. And that's probably debatable. The last essay was the RLDS Reaction to Section 132 by Newell Bringhurst. And it's interesting, this has changed through the years. I think we all know that one of the reasons for the RLDS Church, Community of Christ, to divide from the mainstream LDS Church. Was one of the issues was over polygamy, that they didn't believe that Joseph Smith practiced it and so forth. That has changed through the years. And in the administration of President Grant McMurray, he admitted, in his personal view anyway, that Joseph Smith did live plural marriage. So that reaction has changed through the years. Okay, now just quickly, my talk is really kind of a review and a preview. So now I'll go to the preview part and talk to you a little bit about the essay that I've been asked to submit. And I appreciate, really, the confidence.
I think that's part of your essay.
Oh, did I leave that there?
Yeah, I think it was left at the main desk or something.
Oh, yeah, that's my last page. Thank you. I'm going to have to wing that. Very anticlimactical. let's see. I do want to thank Craig and Newell for the confidence they have in me to write an essay. The title is Section 132, From a Fundamentalist Mormon Perspective. And that, in and of itself, is... Oh, no, this is... I've got my last page. I don't know where that came from.
I don't know what the...
That would have been the last page of the one I gave you already.
Yeah, but I've already got 26.
Don't confuse me.
Sorry.
I guess I got two 26s.
I guess so.
Well, anyway... So what I've done, when they asked me to do that, from a fundamentalist Mormon perspective, my first thought was, I'm only one. How am I going to get the perspective from all the different kinds of fundamentalist Mormons that I've just explained to you are very diverse? So I thought, well, the only way I can really do that and even approach the perspective from a variety of people is to devise a questionnaire and send that out to a lot of people. I know thousands of people in the lifestyle or in at least the belief system of fundamentalist Mormons. So I devised a 5-question questionnaire and was very pleased with the response. I got 120 of them back from all the groups that we deal with and the independents. And so because of that, my last part of the chapter is a result of the questionnaire analysis of that. But first of all, I wanted to kind of set the stage on my essay, so I talked about a definition of terms first, so that we'd all understand that in the early days of the church, especially in Joseph Smith and Brigham Young's administration, they used interchangeably with polygamy, new and everlasting covenant, celestial marriage, patriarchal marriage. And I have quotes to show that those were the same thing. They didn't have any difference in the meaning. And then probably, I can't remember exactly when it started to change, but I have those dates and figures too, where all of a sudden they were two different things. Celestial marriage meant you married a monogamy in the temple, polygamy was something else. So I wanted to go into the definition of terms on that. My next section is on a brief history of Section 132. I, too, along with Craig and Newell, agree that, it's a quote from Daniel Bachman in an article in Journal of Mormon History, where he says, quote, amalgamation of several separate communications to Joseph Smith, each given at separate times and under different circumstances. That's the Section 132, the revelation that has been put out in 1843. So I did a lot of research on that, and I found at least six times when he received some kind of communication or revelation on plural marriage. The first was in 1829, when he was translating the Book of Mormon. The next was 1831, early, when he was working on the inspired revision of the Old Testament. The next one was also in 1831 when he gave when he was on a mission to the American Indians, and he told the people, the brethren there, he says, and the day will come when, in fact, he said, I encourage you to take from among the daughters of the Lamanites wives. And then later he was asked, well, how can we do that if we're already married? And so he said, well, it's plural marriage aspect. 1834, when an angel, one of the times, when an angel commanded him to take Mary Rawlins Leitner as a plural wife. 1835, while translating the Book of Mormon, Abraham. And then 1843, of course, when he put them all together and dictated the revelation to William Clayton. Also along this history of 132, Do you know how many times that introductory paragraph was changed from the time it was first put in the DNC in 1876? It's now 2011. Do you know how many times that introductory section was changed? One, two, three. Anyway, it was three. And so I quoted each one. I went to the university special collections and got all the old ones out and compared. So this is probably already done. I think I reinvented the wheel. But it was put in 1876, then changed in 1921, and then again in 1979. And then according to a couple of fundamentalist Mormon sources, and keep in mind that I'm presenting this from a fundamentalist Mormon point of view, there were two additional paragraphs that were added on to Section 132 that have not been widely circulated, and I found those and quoted those two paragraphs. You have to buy the book to find out what that is. but apparently this information was given to John Tater, who gave it to Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith gave it to John Tater, and then he gave it to Lauren Woolley, and it was been passed down. Okay, my next section was plural marriage as a law of the priesthood, and I explained that earlier. That for several years it was a law of priesthood, and then both a law of the church and the priesthood, and now we believe it is still a law of the priesthood that we can live with the authority that's been passed down. It's interesting to look at the wording in Section 132. Ogden did this. I'll give him the credit. That was my husband. When you itemize how many times some of these words have been used in Section 132, law, which we refer to as a law of plural marriage, was mentioned 32 times. Covenant or commandment was mentioned 30 times. And this is just in Section 132. Priesthood, 14 times. Keys of the priesthood power, 6 times. How many times was church mentioned? 0. So I think it's trying to put across the point here that this is a priesthood law, a commandment, a covenant, and not focused on as a law of the church. Only when they vote on it as such. My next section is the importance of Section 132, and it's amazing to learn how many things are taught in that section other than plural marriage. For example, what is meant by the fullness of the gospel? All these things are answered in there. What is the only popular religion in heaven? How to return to God's presence? How man can become a god? How to be assured of eternal propagation? And the conditions for remarriage? And the penalty for rejecting plural marriage. All these things are mentioned in this section, so it's very significant for a lot of other reasons than just plural marriage. You'll notice, I'm sure, that the importance of Section 132 is diminished greatly in the LDS Church. It's really an embarrassment to them now. But in 1856, a member had to believe in plural marriage to get a temple recommend. And from at least 1940 on, a recommend could not be given to somebody who in any way advocated polygamy or affiliated with polygamists. And so I go through some of the differences in the recommend questions and trace those on down through the years. My next section is, and I'm just about through here, the part in verse 7 that says one on earth at a time that has the keys of this priesthood. That's probably the most controversial verse in the whole section. And it was interesting to see the response in the questionnaire to that question. The wording in this verse has not been changed since the time it was dictated by Joseph Smith to William Clayton in 1843. Some people think that, oh, maybe that was added, because there is that parenthetical expression that says... Joseph Smith being the one God appointed in the last days. In fact, a quote, according to the, Joseph Smith himself says, according to the law, I, Joseph Smith, hold the keys of this power in the last days, for there is never but one on earth at a time on whom this power and its keys are conferred. And that's in the documentary history of the church. But it's paraphrasing a little bit that verse 7. So, just skipping along, I spent several pages on that, giving quotes why I personally and many fundamentalists do think that that's Joseph Smith, but that is really a controversial subject, and we have many answers that come from that, from the different members of the groups. Okay, the Law of Sarah, you probably all understand what that is, but I go into a few quotes on that. It's kind of interesting. Is it the first, an existing wife, that gives permission in the law of Sarah for other wives to come into the family, or is it all the existing wives that give permission for other wives to come in? If a man wants a harmonious family, just from common sense, I would say get the existing wives to approve, because they have to live with the other wives a lot more than you do. Then an analysis of the questionnaire, and I'm not going to go into detail on that, but it's really interesting to get a broader perspective of Section 132 from a variety of fundamentalist Mormons. The groups that I contacted were Apostolic United Brethren, AUB, Kingston's or Davis County Co-op, Centennial Park, Nelson Naylor, Independence, and those. And I invited FLDS, Warren Jeff's group, to participate. I knew some of the people down there, but they refused to participate, which is nothing unusual. Even some of our own people that belong to some of these other groups and are independents are still very hesitant in speaking up publicly. It's still a risk. It's a felony in Utah. So even though I promised anonymity to these people, some of them are still hesitant in participating. But I feel like 120 gives you a pretty good idea of the perspective that we have of Section 132. Okay, in conclusion, the importance of Section 132 to fundamentalist Mormons was rated a 10 by about 75% of those returning their questionnaires. I asked them to rate from 1 to 10, how important is Section 132 to you and your belief in plural marriage? And over three-quarters of them said it was a 10, the others 8, 9. And the reasons, I'm imagining, and some of them made a comment to this effect, there are so many other places that where you were commanded to live that law that 132 isn't the only place. So they placed it as important, but not the only reason why they feel like they should live it. Indeed, the information contained in Section 132 is but a small portion of the revealed knowledge available about plural marriage. Joseph Smith said he could not reveal to the saints 1/100th part of what he knew. So how can we mortals expect to totally understand the complete gospel? If he couldn't even reveal it then, we certainly don't have it now. The prophet explained this beautifully in the King Follett Discourse. Quote, "When you climb a ladder, you must begin at the bottom and ascend step by step until you arrive at the top. So it is with the principles of the gospel. You must begin with the first and go on until you learn all the principles of exaltation. But it will be a great while after you have passed through the veil before you will have learned them. It is not all to be comprehended in this world. It will be a great work to learn our salvation and exaltation even beyond the grave." So I'll conclude with the statement in the last verse of Section 132, "Let this suffice for the present." Thank you.
Well, I will speak probably much shorter than Anne because I'm not as well prepared as she is. I didn't do a review of the book. I just felt to say that congratulations to Neil and Craig for the refreshing approach in publishing The Persistence of Polygamy. I have seen their diligence in to try to add something new and worthwhile to the discussion of plural marriage. I have especially admired their own research in taking a deeper look into why plural marriage persists, with an effort to understand, not just rehearse, their own understanding. One of the things that... I can't remember who said it. That was said recently was that new questions need to be asked if we intend to have a deeper understanding. And the problem with that, do you know who said that? Who was it that said that?
No.
I do. I can picture her face. But I can't think of who said it.
I think it was one of the, either in the conclusion or the introduction, I think it might have been Linda Newell.
Who was the other one?
Or Jesse Embry.
It was Jesse Embry.
It was Jesse Embry.
But she failed suggest what those questions were. But that was very insightful, and I think the better our questions are, the better the answers that we'll get. My contribution to Volume 3 will be two essays. The first one will be a historical overview of the period approximately 1920 to 1940 of what was then what began to be called fundamentalist Mormonism. They began to coalesce. I will cover many of the events surrounding Nathaniel Baldwin and his radio factory. In that story, I will tell the role of John and Lauren Woolley, who were pivotal figures in providing the priesthood authority and a mission for continued plural marriage outside the church. And it was interesting because you have, during that period of time, people that were living plural marriage that were leftovers, if you will, from the post-manifesto era. You also had a small, seemingly handful that I wish we could do more research on, of new plural marriages that were performed by various individuals, stake presidents perhaps, like Craig's mother's grandfather that was a musser. That we don't know who performed their marriages, we don't know why, but they were living plural marriage at that time, sort of in out of the church. It wasn't a clear-cut line. And then you have those that coalesced around John and Laura Woolley for new plural marriages, and they kind of melded together during this period of time in the teens and 1920s. I will rely heavily on the diaries of Nathaniel Baldwin, Joseph Musser, and Joseph Lyman Jessup, my grandfather, not my cousin, who's going to give the essay in the third volume. I will also tell about the 1935 beginnings of Short Creek as a fundamentalist refuge for men and their wives who sought to evade the radar of law enforcement with the legislation enacted in 1935 to make unlawful cohabitation a felony for the first time. I will discuss the role of the 1933 final manifesto and the subsequent church-authorized surveillance that began in 1938 with the assignment given to Bishop Freddie Curtis. Those church surveillance records became the basis for the state and federal raids on polygamists in 1944. And finally, I will discuss some of the roots of division that eventually spawned the split among fundamentalist Mormons. And by the way, I found it very interesting to learn that Freddie Curtis, who was a convert, whose parents were converts to the church, he had no polygamist ancestry, his daughter ended up in Colorado City, where she paid her tithing until the end of her life.
Interesting.
My second essay will be the paper that I presented at the Mormon History Association in St. George this past May, which I entitled there, Exploring the Polygamist Ancestry of Contemporary Fundamentalist Mormons. That was spawned by my response. I was asked to do a book review of George Smith's book, Nauvoo Polygamy. And that was spawned as a result of doing that review because I realized that in my professional life as a family historian, I have done hundreds and hundreds of pedigrees of mainstream Mormons as well as fundamentalist Mormons, and I've seen the constant polygamist ancestry of both. And so I wanted to do a paper to see how that might have affected or connected or how much awareness fundamentalist Mormons had with their polygamist past. Whether how many lines, as in my line, I have four generations, I'm a fifth generation Mormon and whose ancestors lived plural marriage, fundamentalist, but they never stopped from early Utah to now. And I was curious about how many had Nauvoo ancestors. And I came up with a list by the time I was done with about just under 700 men and women, and some of those were Nauvoo polygamists. And it was very interesting to see how those connections played in, and that's what I will explore in the third essay. I had some response to that paper from a statistician who gave me the information that I had all the elements, I just didn't know it, to be able to say that there was a direct influence between having this polygamist ancestry and those that continued on with it. And so that will be my contribution to the third volume. I'm looking forward to these volumes. I really do think, Craig and Neil, that you have offered something that is very... You set about to provoke discussion and further research, and this is something I think you've done. Congratulations.
See if my presentation will come up here. We've heard a lot of very interesting things, kind of a smattering of what's upcoming. Both Mary Ann and Ann talked a lot about things that will be in volume number 3, and which will deal with mostly, is it post-1890, post-1904 polygamy. I'm actually going to talk just a minute about the article that Don Bradley and I did that will be in volume 2. And volume 2 focuses on post-Nauvoo up until the Manifesto. And it's an important period because the Utah Mormons are getting settled into some kind of form of polygamy. How do you live it? The U.S. government enters in 1862 and then in the 1880s trying to prevent it. In the meantime, and this is what Don and I are writing about, there is this conflict between the LDS Joseph, which is Joseph F. Smith, the son of Hiram Smith, and the RLDS Joseph, which is Joseph Smith III, the president of the RLDS Church. And they... due to this conflict, there's Joseph Smith III. But in response to the RLDS missionaries' claims that Joseph Smith did not practice plural marriage, the Utah church members recorded their recollections of Nauvoo polygamy. And the article will talk about this conflict, but also in some degree what records were generated. The missionaries that we know visited Utah were David and Alexander, and then later Joseph Smith III. Frederick Hare died in 1862, and he was a little bit more aloof anyway, so he wasn't one of the players. And this is Louis Bittman, Emma Smith's second husband. But what is important is because of their claims, 4 caches of information on Nauvoo polygamy were created. And the first of these was the Joseph F. Smith affidavit books, and there's 4 of these. They're currently located in the Church History Library. As you can see, Book 1 and Book 4 have a title page which reads 40 Affidavits of Celestial Marriage. And then the other 2 books, of course, do not have those titles. Book 1 and Book 2 have somebody penciled in the numbers. We don't know who that is. That isn't Joseph F. Smith, even though he's the primary mover in making these, having these books made. But we also see Joseph F. Smith has his name imprinted in them. And so what it's telling us is that Books 1 and 2 were in Joseph F. Smith's personal possession. And then the church historian's office ended up with Books 3 and 4. Book 4 has this title on the front, and so it at some point was deposited in the church archives vault, probably just because it seemed so important. And then when Dan Bachman found these in the early 1970s, they were scattered, but by the time that Todd Compton saw them in the early 1890s, they were all together. Now, looking at the content of these books, we find that there are affidavits. They are notarized. They are stamped. This is Melissa Lott's affidavit that she was married to Joseph Smith. And you'll notice it's Malissa, M-A-L. If there's any a confusion. There's her own signature. It's an M-A-L, which is a funny spelling, but she even repeated it when she signed it in book four. And what the point here is that book one and four are identical. One is not a copy of the other. Both of them contain their own affidavits, suggesting that Joseph F. Smith wanted his own set that were valid and a set for the church that was equally valid and useful. Also within these books are testimonials and letters and things. This is the testimony of Benjamin F. Johnson. He had a lot to say about plural marriage. It started on page 3. It ends on page 9, but there's his signature. There's the notary, James Jack, with his stamp. So the books are full of really good notarized statements. They're all late recollections. The article will also have this chart in it. I don't know how John Hamer's going to format it, but what it has is the person who was giving the affidavit or the testimony, the date it was given. These books 1 and 4 are nearly identical, and the page numbers, a little bit of a description of what it contains, and then when it was first published is over here. And then books 2 and 3, similarly, these were obtained in 1870, and then there's some copies, and these are, in fact, copies of free affidavits that were copied into the books. The other affidavits are the ones that are in red, and these were all obtained during the same time. Apparently, Joseph F. Smith didn't have the books with him, so he had free affidavits signed by participants. Marianne Frost, a wife of Party P. Pratt, Orson Hyde, Eliza Partridge, who was a plural wife of Joseph Smith, Martha McBride, another plural wife of Joseph Smith. And for our own benefit, and these I don't know, are these restricted, Don? They weren't hard for me to look at, but I can't remember. You may just have to apply for permission. They're not that hard to get at, but to see the digitized copies. But what the church has done, the historians down there, have added all of these affidavits in black, which are also part of this same collection. So all of the affidavits dealing with novel polygamy are in one collection. In fact, here is one. And somebody asked me earlier, did Joseph Smith have any children? I think he had two that we can identify. There's references to a third. One is a child to Olive Frost, and both she and the child died. We don't know the gender. Before the saints left Nauvoo. The second one is signed here by Josephine Fisher, and she recounts that her mother, Sylvia Sessions, said that she was married to Joseph, and that Josephine is Joseph's biological offspring, and it's contained in this collection as well. They were not published until 1879, just weeks after the RLDS Church published their account of the interview of Emma, where Emma said Joseph Smith was never a polygamist. The Utah Saints would hear none of that, and they dug these affidavits out and published 7 of them in this article in the Deseret News just weeks later. The second cache of documents comes from Andrew Jensen, who in the early 1887 and late 1886 did some research for an article that he published. And if you go to his papers, there are 18 documents, and this is a collection that Don did, outlining their content, but looking at just some of the examples here. Don, this is document number 1. It's a list of Joseph Smith's plural wives. He was talking to Melissa Lott here. Don figured this out. This is Eliza Snow's handwriting, which is kind of exciting. Fanny Alger's name is there. I talked about that this morning. But this is a significant document in who and where Andrew Jensen got his information, but also who they were. This is document number 10, a biography of Fanny Alger. Again, I talked about that this morning, but just to show you that he had biographical sheets on a number of the plural wives, important material recorded there that was otherwise unknown. This is document number, I want to say 10, can't remember, but anyway, there's 18 of them. This is a very important one, talks about Ruth Vole Sayers and an eternity-only ceiling. It's a very important cache of documents that has helped form and helped us understand Joseph Smith's polygamy. The third cache is the articles that are published in the Historical Record in 1887. The Historical Record, you'll find bound copies of volumes 5 through 8 or 9. The reasons they're bound without volumes 1 through 4 is volumes 1 through 4 were published in Danish, which was Andrew Jensen's native tongue. But this is the article published in July of 1887 on plural marriage. Towards the end of the article, he lists 26 of Joseph Smith's plural wives. This is the first list anybody ever makes. And it's very accurate. Todd Compton used these and added a few more. I think they're all accurate. If this chart will also be in the article, where I've gone through this article on plural marriage, listed who is saying what, whether it's an affidavit, testimony, when it was recorded, and the page number in that article in the historical record. The last group are the temple lot testimony. The temple lot transcripts, the RLDS Church attempted to gain control of the Independence, Missouri temple lot from the Hedrickites. And they did it by saying, we are the actual heirs of Joseph Smith's church, so we just own it outright. These guys are usurpers. They don't belong there. They don't own it. And polygamy became a big issue, because if polygamy was practiced by Joseph Smith's church, and the RLDS church doesn't practice polygamy, then they can't be the natural heirs, and they don't own the temple lot. Well, the RLDS prevailed in the primary court, but on appeal, the Hedrickites prevailed and retained possession of the temple lot. This is the first page. If you look at it, the actual document is 1,750 pages long. There's a couple of edited versions out there sold by Herald House and Price Publishing. They're not useful because they're so heavily edited. Now, you can't blame them. It's 1,750 pages, but they are so heavily edited that I don't think they're very useful. I have both copies, hoping I was getting the originals when I originally bought them. But what I have done is gone through those pages 1 through 46 as a table of contents. Then part 2 is the complainant's testimony, pages 1 through 696. But I have listed who is being deposed, kind of what their identity is, and whether they talk about polygamy. And then on part 3 is the respondent's testimony, pages 1 through page 812, who it is, what are those persons significant, did they talk about polygamy, and then the part 4 is where they're winding up their arguments. But the point that I would make is, if I had had this one article when I started, when Don and I started our research on Joseph Smith's polygamy, the amount of time it would have saved me would have been worth thousands and thousands of dollars. And anybody who's going to look at Nauvoo polygamy will ironically want to get a copy of Volume 2, because it outlines all of these things. But what's also interesting is that if the RLDS Church in 1860 had not reorganized, let's just say there was no RLDS Church, or let's say that the RLDS Church reorganized, but they said, okay, Joseph was a polygamist, he shouldn't have done it. It is probable that the Utah Saints would not have, that Joseph F. Smith would not have made these affidavits. And this is Don Bradley's observation. I'm stealing his observation. It's very insightful. Andrew Jensen probably wouldn't have written this article, or at least been as aggressive. He wouldn't have gotten the participation of all of these plural wives, remembering what happened in Nauvoo. They wouldn't have been motivated if they weren't fighting against those evil RLDS. And the article wouldn't have appeared, but the Temple Lot testimony never would have happened either. And the problem is, if we did not have these, and I asked Todd Compton, I said, without these four sources, what would we lose? And the estimate was like 3/4 of all of the things that we know about Joseph Smith's Nauvoo polygamy would be lost. And we are ironically, paradoxically, grateful to the RLDS Church and their missionaries for preserving the memory of Nauvoo polygamy. It is very paradoxical. But anyway, that's the outline of my article. It'll be in Volume 2.
And Don's
article. Sorry. I don't mean to cut you out there. Anyway, thank you.
Well, as you can tell, we're all very excited about this whole project, and it indeed has provoked discussion and further research, is what, you know, and that was really one of the primary purposes of this whole project, as well as to illuminate the knowledge of this very important, essential part of Mormonism. Now I'm going to open it up for questions from the audience. I'm sure there must be questions. And you, those of you who are asking questions, I would appreciate it that if you would, I guess it'll pick it up. Hopefully the microphone is, I don't know, to ask you to come forward or just be clear and concise. And who you want to direct your questions to, which of the panelists you'd like to.
They say on the instructions for the chairs to make sure that the person speaks into the mic or
maybe I could repeat the question.
You probably won't pick it up.
Yeah, well, why don't you ask the question? I will repeat it, and then they will answer. That'll save people having to try to come up here. Okay, go ahead. Let's do it that way. Question. Do I have any questions?
Well, I'll ask a simple question of Brian. The publication of Joseph Smith's affidavits, and my name's Clark Layton, I talked with you before. You have a date of 1869. That's not the date that they were collected. That's just, what does that date refer to? Is part of my question. And how did Josephine's, whose affidavit was done, I think, in the early 20th century, make it into that collection? And also, she was not a wife.
Would you come up and maybe answer, repeat the question and answer? Okay. Go ahead.
Question number one is, what is the 1869 dating? In 1866, the first RLDS missionaries came to Utah. In 1869, Alexander and David Smith shows up. Now, these are Joseph F. Smith's cousins. So there's this showdown, and it's a true showdown right there in Salt Lake. But in anticipation of their arrival, he goes around and collects affidavits from seven of Joseph Smith's plural wives who are still living. And he holds them up in one of the accounts and shows them as he's confronting his cousins who are saying Joseph wasn't a polygamist. He doesn't quote from them according to the newspaper account, but he holds them up. But he also continues to acquire additional affidavits, testimonials, throughout the rest of 1869 until volumes 1 and 4 are filled. And then in 1870, he begins the second volumes 3 and 4. And so there are a few that were recorded in 1870. So 1869 is when they were actually written down, and it's all recorded there. You can see the dates, and I've got them in the chart as well. The second question was the affidavit on Josephine Fisher. Just prior to her mother's death, Sylvia Sessions. Sylvia Sessions was a plural wife of Joseph Smith, but Sylvia drew Josephine to her bedside, said, "I want you to know that Joseph Smith is your father." Kind of a dramatic thing. There were rumors going around Salt Lake City of her existence prior to this. It was 1882, I think, when Sylvia died. Maybe in 1884, but it was right in there. So people knew about Josephine before this, but she didn't tell anybody until 1915. And that's when it was written down, and there were church... Was Andrew Jensen one of them? There were several church historians who went out to her and wrote it down and put forth effort to get this recorded. And so that's where that comes from, Josephine Fisher. Fisher's her married name. And then the last question was?
Well, I was just curious how that made it into the 1869 volume.
Oh, it actually is a free affidavit. That last chart are a bunch of free affidavits, free papers that people wrote out. And they have been into that collection. The church has put all these additional affidavits that came later, just so that you've got this one collection of Nauvoo polygamy affidavits. It's really a nice thing that they've done, actually, to put all them together.
Yes.
Other questions? Oh, yes.
Yeah, how disturbed is Salt Lake by discussions and books on polygamy, do you think?
How what?
What was that again?
How disturbed is Salt Lake on discussions and books on polygamy?
You're talking about the mainline LDS church?
Yeah, yes, because my impression is they would just as soon completely disassociate themselves with it. And, you know, if you look at the manuals, say, on Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, the priesthood manuals, it would be hard to discern that they were ever polygamists.
Well, I'll put in my two cents a little bit on this one by kind of giving you an example of how the whole Warren Jeffs thing has come down. You know, I live out in California, so I'm not as attuned to the coverage of local coverage of polygamy, but just in watching how the LDS owned and operated Deseret News has covered the Warren Jeffs trial and all the stuff that's come down and comparing it. And Craig and I have talked about this, and the way that the more secular Salt Lake Tribune has covered the same affair. It's interesting. The LDS Church has, you know, they're very uncomfortable with their polygamous heritage. I think that's the bottom line. The LDS Church is extremely uncomfortable with the church's polygamous heritage, and I personally feel bad about that because I come out of an LDS background myself. I had ancestors on both sides who practiced polygamy, and I'm very proud of my LDS heritage, including those who sacrificed for the principle. Because in fact, Craig and I, in the dedication to this book, put in there our dedication to those, the females especially, who made the sacrifice for the principle. And so so the LDS Church, I think today, would just as soon not discuss it.
Why?
Well, because I think a lot of it is because of the fact that the LDS Church, in many ways, is trying to become more mainstream, more acceptable by the larger American society, and bringing up the topic of polygamy tends to impede that process. That's my take on it. Maybe my fellow panel members have a different take on that. Brian, would you?
What I think is that polygamy is gospel meat, and that DNC 1922, if you give meat to those who need milk, they will perish. It's difficult to understand polygamy except libido is driving the force, and it's hard to turn it into a religious aspect unless you already believe Joseph Smith was inspired and a true prophet. And so it's easily misunderstood. It's gospel meat, and I don't think you'll ever see it in the Ensign, the Church News, in the Deseret News, Mormon Times. It's just never going to be there because that's milk. There's too many milk drinkers that are reading those publications, and even the Gospel Doctrine and the Priesthood Manuals, they're just not going to talk about polygamy. It is talked about. It is part of our doctrine. Nobody's denying that, I would argue. But you don't. If you want gospel meat nowadays, you've got to go to some of the higher councils where things are not published, or find it in other sources. But for me, it's just milk and meat. People criticize the church for hiding it. I just don't see it that way. You're just not going to see it anywhere there's a milk drinker, and that's almost different.
Well, may I just comment? It's an embarrassment because we're different. And we've talked about, among fundamentalist Mormons, decriminalizing it, reducing it from a felony, which it has no business being a felony. But anyway, we could never, well, I shouldn't say never, that's a goal that we have. It's going to be a long time because of the LDS influence. They do not want to see it reduced from a felony. They're the ones that were instrumental in it, influencing it to be put in the beginning in 1935. So it makes us different from the other states. So now that we've got two Mormons running for president, they're more interested in really hushing it so that they have a chance to be accepted by the nation.
Yes?
I have another question. In view of the events of the last week, this is an open question to any of the panelists. Would any of you care to respond and share what your personal reaction was to the conviction of Jeff's, and possibly how we, as Utah Mormons or the Utah culture, should view this?
Mary Ann, would you like to? You haven't answered a question yet. Go ahead.
I'll answer that question simply because I have a lot of FLDS relatives, and I've been very much aware of it for a long time. Warren Jeffs never would have had the authority he did if it wasn't for his father, Ruin, making the one-man rule. And he instituted that idea. It became instituted under him. But Warren Jeffs is simply someone that came up and stole power at every opportunity. He was an opportunist. He was a pervert from a very young age. And I have heard that from many sources. And to find that how bad it was, there have been leaks. We have been privy to some of those leaks. We knew some of what was coming down. in this trial, but we had no idea it was that bad. It makes every one of us turn our stomachs. And it's not anything that we can relate to, and we are offended that anything like that is connected with religion, period, let alone with Joseph Smith. That's our take on it. And I don't think it's widespread, but I think that since Texas has been diligent in putting some of those men behind prison bars, that those people down there were most likely to be the ones involved with it. Willie Jessup, when he found out about it, he withdrew. He said, I can no longer in conscience support this man, as soon as he found out about it. And so if others would take that position, but they have had such a heads down mentality for so long, it's very, very difficult, because Warren has told them not to watch TV, and they're not to believe anything they hear about him, and it's going to be a long while before they take a good look at it. But the people I know would be horrified if they knew the truth.
I could just give a personal example of somebody I know. She's down there waiting in a hotel. She might have testified today, but she was raped by Warren Jess at age 7, and it affected her whole life. This is just one of many cases. See, there's a lot of evidence they can't bring out in the trial stages, but now it's in the penalty stages, they can bring out a lot more evidence. And so they're bringing in girls or women now that were physically and sexually abused by him, and it's really hard for this one girl. I mean, she's had been hospitalized throwing up because she doesn't want to see him again, she doesn't want to face him. And it recalls a lot of those memories. But she says, I'm willing to do it if it'll put him behind bars for life.
Anybody else care to comment? Either Craig or...
No.
Another question. Go ahead.
I'll come up and ask.
Sure,
it so
go
it,
ahead.
It can
go
hear.
Ahead.
I've recently read a couple of books on the Civil War. And one of them particularly had a long section on Buchanan, President Buchanan, and then they were talking about the twin relics of barbarism being the platform for the Republican Party. They never mentioned that one phrase about the twin relics of in either of the books being the twin relics of barbarism, and they didn't mention anything about Johnston's army coming out or anything. I was just curious, do we tend as Mormons to play up that statement about, there's two questions. We play that statement up a lot more than other historians in other parts of the country. And is there any research on polygamy that's going on that is not part of the Mormon community? That someone else says, this is a fascinating topic and I'm doing research on it and I have no Mormon relatives or no Mormon interest whatsoever?
Well, in answer to the first question, I mean, obviously it's a big event for Utah and Mormon history. So I'm sure that we do make more of a thing of it than others would, but my comment is that was just poor research on their part. If they didn't mention Johnston's army, they didn't mention all of the political and social aspects surrounding that, because it certainly had an effect nationally with Bleeding Kansas going on at the time, with a good portion of the military being sent out west. It had a significant impact on social and political events of that time. So if they didn't bring it up, that's just poor research on their part. Now, the second part is there actually have been non-Mormons who have looked at Mormon polygamy. We have Larry Foster, for example, Sally Gordon. So there are non-Mormons who look at Mormon polygamy. If you're talking about polygamy, non-Mormon polygamy, I'm not as aware, because, to be honest, I guess I'm a little bit this way. I've focused on Mormon plural marriage.
Well, I think there's been a couple of books, and I can't think there's one out there that has tried to look at polygamy within a larger context outside of Mormon.
Cultural, that's right.
The cultural, yeah. And I can't remember the name of it. It's a book.
Did contemporary. Yeah.
Yes.
Contemporary
yes.
Polygamy, and I'm trying to think who the author is.
Only. Yeah,
it was a sociological study. It was basically a
a sociological study, and I can't think of the study. In fact, I have the book in my library, and I'm ashamed to say that I can't come up with the title. And one thing that'd be interesting, and this was actually brought up at I think the Farrakhan conference in kind of a negative sort of a way, is what I would like to see, and this is just they're throwing this out, is maybe drawing more comparisons and examinations in looking at polygamy as practice within Islam. As compared with polygamy practice within Mormonism, because I had a chance to talk with a guy who lives in the LA area, and he was talking about how there were quite a few Muslims that live in the LA area. He was a guy that moved their furniture and stuff. In fact, I met him at MHA, and I'm trying to think of his name. But anyway, he was saying that they were actually practicing polygamy in the LA area, Islamic polygamy, and he went in, there was all his wives in this big huge home and everything else, and that might be an interesting area of investigation. Look at that, not only Islamic polygamy as practice compared to Mormon polygamy in the Middle East, or where Islam is predominant, but here in the United States, because as we're well aware, we're that's one of the fastest growing religious groups within the United States itself. I think that is a fascinating area that bears few.
There are actually a number of Muslims who at least semi-openly practice polygamy in the United States as well as in Western Europe and Britain.
I want to make a comment that they claim, and I don't know the truth of this, but Christian polygamists claim there's over 100,000 polygamists in the United States that are non-Mormon.
Right, non-Mormon. Yeah, yeah.
That's Mark Hinkle. He's kind of as a self-appointed person. We communicate with him once in a while. We have an agreement with him. He'll recommend the media come to us about Mormon polygamy. We recommend if it's about Christian polygamy, we refer him. And he has made that statement. And he is one, and he knows them. A lot of them.
Anybody have one last question? And then I guess we're almost at the end of our time. I just looked up and saw it's 6 o'clock. Yes, question back there, please.
Yeah, I read some on a blog post, and it was kind of a what-if type of question. So this is the question sent from this blog. They were saying that maybe in 20 years they would take out Section 132 and replace it with propagation of the family. So my question is to the panel, how likely is that? And
what was the question about 132 again, I guess?
Taking Section 132 out of the standard works and putting in the proclamation to the family.
I feel like that is
repeat that with
The question. Go ahead. Repeat.
The question was if the LDS Church will remove Section 132 from the Doctrine and Covenants and replace it with the proclamation on the family.
That's a great question, because I think I could answer it pretty definitively, even though maybe I ought to let Craig answer. Go ahead. Why don't you tackle that one?
I don't think they will. Because doctrinally, there is so much within Section 132, I cannot see how they could ever remove it from the Doctrine and Covenants.
Because that's my opinion. Yeah, it deals with so many fundamental aspects of Mormon, unique Mormon belief, temple, the importance of temple ordinances, exaltation. The importance of the family in the hereafter. I mean, just those are the highlights, as well as other aspects. So it's never going to happen. I guess that's the end of our session, and I really appreciate your attendance.
Thank you.